Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Money talks, or at least pumps up the volume. So no wonder they're shouting about this one.
All parts of the political spectrum, whether you're to the left, in the center, or to the right, politically speaking, this ruling helps everyone equally. It is the ultimate in a nonpartisan issue.
Nonpartisan? In Washington? Nice try.
The Roberts Court has turned back the clock on our democracy by over a century. This disastrous decision paves the way for free and an unlimited special interest spending in our elections.
The Supreme Court opens up the floodgates on vested interest campaign spending. Is it a license to steamroll or a victory for free speech? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning to you. It is Friday, January 22nd. I'm Miles O'Brien, in for Celeste Headlee, enjoying the last day of her vacation. And, John, I suppose there are station managers at local TV stations all across the nation who are just dancing this
That's
morning
right,
at the prospect
of those campaign ads.
Of all these ads that are going to be flooding their way.
Yeah, that money goes directly into television stations. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. As we've been telling you, the Supreme Court ruled yesterday, in effect, that money equals speech. The 5-4 decision says big business and labor unions have a free speech right to spend as much as they want to persuade voters in elections. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs condemned the ruling.
I don't think anybody thinks that we spend too little money on political commercials and on political campaigns.
Joining us now is Dane Strother. He's a Democratic campaign consultant and is a partner in the D.C. firm Strother Strategies. And Dane, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, if I'm a campaign director, do I suddenly, read the newspaper and immediately update my Rolodex, make sure I can get in touch with Exxon and AIG?
Well, at least on my side, we won't phone AIG or Exxon, but we'll certainly get to know our brothers in the unions better than we do now. But overall, let me say this, let the First Amendment ring.
And this is a good thing from your view?
Absolutely. It's been a charade prior to this, quite honestly. Look, corporations have been running ads for years. I know I've been making them.
All right. Dane Strother, stay with us. We're going to have a debate on this in just a moment. Chris Shays is going to join us, former Republican congressman.
President Obama says it's a fight he's ready to have.
Never again will the American taxpayer be held hostage by a bank that is too big to fail.
He's calling for tougher regulations that would include limiting the size of banks. Speaking earlier on The Takeaway, Louise Story, the finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times, told us that's a reversal.
And that is very interesting because, of course, it was the government during the financial crisis that pushed so many banks to merge together. So that's a bit of a reversal of the historical timeline here.
The president's plan would also stop banks from making investments that do not benefit their customers.
To Haiti now, where a massive relocation of 400,000 people is being planned. UN peacekeepers are now leveling land on the outskirts of Port-au-Prince, and they say the mass relocation could start next week. 90% of the city was destroyed, and so former President Bill Clinton, the UN special envoy for Haiti, theorizes that there may be a silver lining in the reconstruction ahead.
I personally believe that they're going to be given the opportunity to, in effect, reimagine their country.
I'd love to know what Haitians think about that. Meanwhile, search and rescue teams are packing up their dogs and gear as hopes for finding survivors from last week's earthquake dim. Overseas airports in India are on high alert this morning after intelligence services say they received information that Al-Qaeda-linked militants were plotting to hijack a plane. And they've had a $2 billion budget and 7 years to prepare for next month's Winter Olympics in Vancouver, but they're missing the snow. Games will still go on. Man-made snow, stockpiled snow, will be brought in by dump trucks if it doesn't start falling soon. Asian and European markets down. Futures mixed. The Dow gets underway at 10,389. The S&P opens at 1,116. And the NASDAQ at 2,265. John Yoo is going to join us later on in the hour, the author of the so-called torture memos. We'll get a rationale from him. And we're going to be talking about that Supreme Court decision, money equals speech. Do you believe that that is valid? You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Dale Struthers and Chris Shea is next.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. You know, Miles O'Brien, guys like you and me should be pretty happy this morning.
And tell me why.
Well, we talk.
It's Friday.
For a living, right?
Oh, yes, we do.
Yeah. So if money equals speech,
oh, so
we're rich guys.
Each word.
Oh, yeah.
To ka-ching.
Yeah.
Huh?
I mean, we should be feeling pretty happy this morning. But no. A 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court threw out a law designed to limit the influence of big business and labor unions on elections. The court overturned two of its own decisions, along with a 63-year-old law ruling that corporations and unions may spend as much as they want to support or oppose candidates for president and Congress. A ban on direct contributions to candidates remains in place. It's essentially an enshrinement of the money equals speech doctrine, which one of our analysts we were talking to this morning says has been lurking in the courts for years. This decision is certainly a landmark. And to debate the implications of it, we are joined by a candidate and a campaign consultant. Two different perspectives. One, Republican Chris Shays from Connecticut was a member of the House of Representatives from 1987 to 2009. Good morning, Congressman Shays.
Good morning.
And also joining us once again, Dane Struther, Democratic consultant who's worked on a number of Senate and presidential campaigns. He's a partner in the D.C. firm Struther Strategies. Dane, welcome back.
Good morning. Thank you.
So, Dane, you've already said that you believe this is positive, that it is essentially a return to honesty. Money equals speech. Therefore, there are some clear marching orders for you as a campaign consultant. Chris Shays, what do you think of this decision?
Well, what you have is unequal speech. You don't have one man, one vote. You have those with the dollars rule. But the bottom line is this. You had the Tillman Act in 1907 banning corporate treasury money. You had the Taft-Hartley Act in 1947 banning union dues money. I mean, the irony there was my wife belonged to a union that supported my opponent, and her money, her forced union dues money, went to support my opponent. What kind of free speech did my wife have? And then you have the 1970 campaign law that limits individual contributions. What the court has effectively done is basically say the Tillman Act is out, the Taft-Hartley Act is out, and people who belong to unions will find that their money is going to campaigns they don't support. And corporations with vast sums of money will be able to spend literally millions and millions and millions to negate the one man, one vote concept, the one voice, one person, one voice concept.
So do you say that the same that holds true for union members and what unions might support, that it might be different from what the actual union member would support, would also apply to shareholders and corporations, that shareholders who own stock are basically
exactly
supporting a corporate agenda?
It's bizarre. And the point is that individuals were not limited in what they could spend. But now you have an artificial organization, and you had being able to spend unlimited sums. But you had a system that worked. You had political action committees. Corporations could ask their stockholders. They could ask their employees to contribute to political action committees,
right.
and then they could spend the money. The same thing for unions.
All right, Dan.
Let me just tell you the other point quickly that's very concerning and should be to anyone is that you have really an activist court that is legislating. You had a 5-4 decision supporting the law, and now you have a 5-4 decision opposing the law, and it just shows that who's ever appointed to the Supreme Court, it's not the merit of the issue, it's their own bias that they bring to the court.
Interesting. Dane Struther, what do you say to that?
Where do I begin? Well, for the great irony, quite honestly, is you found one of the few Republicans in the country who's not cheering, one of the few Democrats in the country who is cheering. But I had a piece in the New York Times a few years ago basically saying you're never going to separate money and power. And the truth is, with all respect to the congressman, the current law has been a charade. I mean, I've been making money. I've been making the television ads with corporate money for years. What we did was call them educational ads, and you never use the word vote for. But you could do anything else you wanted as an educational ad and lay out any problem your opponent had and say, call that congressman. Tell him we're better than that. So all we're doing now is quite honestly being honest.
your reason, that you have a Fed Elections Commission that didn't believe in the law, and so contrary to the law, they allowed this to happen. And they could have put a stop to it right away.
Well, Chris, let me
agree with Dane. They were a fraud.
Let me get a point of clarification from Dane Strother, though. Okay, fine. Let's just say it's better to be honest about it. But do you think it supports democracy to just sort of jump in the tank of money equals power? And that's sort of what this decision is.
Well, money has equaled power all along. I've worked in hundreds and hundreds of political campaigns, and the person with the most money wins about 90% of the time. The person with the most money 90% of the time is the incumbent. Having said that, I'm a former reporter, so I come with this from an ideological bent. It's First Amendment, and it's about disclosure. And if the citizens of Louisiana don't want a United States senator from Exxon, then we can make that decision. But once we know who's paying for what, honestly, as opposed to some fraud, sham entity created Americans for Happiness, which is what we've been doing for years, maybe now we can get to the bottom of who's paying for what.
Chris Shays, do you think disclosure is an incentive here?
The court didn't say that you've got to disclose who it is.
Well, that's why we have Congress.
And frankly, corrupt money beats no money anytime, and I consider this corrupt money.
Well,
and Dane has a vested interest. I mean, I have a vested interest. He has a vested interest. This is more money, frankly, to the guys who put on ads, and they're thrilled to have this.
Now, but is that to say, Chris Shays, if we take Dane Struthers' point, that any talk of campaign finance reform is just absurd unless you really amend this principle that money equals speech and that corporations have speech rights?
No. You know what? What's absurd is you have a Fed Elections Committee that is absolutely rejoicing this law because even after we passed the law to prevent corporate and union dues money in 1907 and to be enforced in 1970, they passed a law that said, you know, you could educate them. That's not education. It's just a fraud using the word education. Tell them to stop stealing money. Call your congressman. Tell them to stop stealing money. That's not education.
All right. Chris Shays from Connecticut was a member of the House of Representatives from 1987 to 2009. Dane Strother, at the top of the hour, you called the union folks your union brothers. Would it be more correct to say your union clients before we go?
No question. Absolutely both. My corporate clients.
All right.
But look, that's why we have Congress. Disclosure is the key. Let's pass laws once we finally fix health care. Let's pass laws on disclosure.
Okay.
So everyone knows who's paying for
Dane Strother, with the other view, Dane Strother, a Democratic consultant who's worked on a number of Senate and presidential campaigns, who has a firm in Washington called Strother Strategies. Two views on the Supreme Court's 5-4 decision striking down McCain-Feingold. It's 15 minutes after the hour. Let's check in on some of the headlines we're following. Miles?
President Obama dealt a blow to big banks yesterday. He's calling for new limits on their size and ability to make risky bets, and don't expect him to back down.
If these folks want a fight, it's a fight I'm ready to have. And my resolve is only strengthened when I see a return to old practices at some of the very firms fighting reform.
Bankers say it's a bad idea. They say the proposals would restrict lending, increase risk, and do little to protect consumers. As we've been discussing all this morning, the Supreme Court tossed out limits on how much companies can spend on political campaigns. The 5-4 ruling overturned a longtime ban. Now businesses can use their own cash to pay directly for campaign ads.
Moving to Haiti, hundreds of thousands of survivors are getting ready to move from makeshift camps to the outskirts of the capital, where there are camps being built as efforts move from rescue to relief in Haiti. One doctor treating an 11-year-old girl in the capital says he's beginning to see glimmers of hope now.
She's still very critical, but she starts to feel better. She starts to dream again about good things.
Haitians living in the U.S. began applying for a government program that allows some of them to stay in the country. And under this temporary protected status program, TPS, they can work here and send money back home. Toyota recalling 2.3 million vehicles to fix accelerators that stick, causing the cars to rev at extremely high speeds. The recall is unrelated to an earlier one that involved gas pedals. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up?
Coming up with the Democrats' filibuster-proof majority broken. What are they going to do now?
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
A Washington takeout and a media takeout this morning. We begin in Washington, where Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, were you there at this sort of Palin moment that happened on Capitol Hill yesterday?
Video, TV cameras, let's all take a step back. All take a step back.
Senator-elect Scott Brown arrives on Capitol Hill, very much mobbed like Sarah Palin. Were you there?
It was a crush. I was there. Yes, I was there. I recorded that sound, and it got I won't say it got totally crazy. I mean, there's big arrivals there all the time, but there was a mad crush waiting for him to arrive, rolling up to the door of the Russell Building. So Scott Brown, the senator-elect from Massachusetts, of course, paying courtesy calls yesterday. He paid a visit on John McCain. He paid a visit on John Kerry, the senior senator from Massachusetts.
How'd that go?
Very courteous. They said they're going to do a triathlon together when John Kerry's hip is feeling better. They've known each other a long time. You know, these are courtesy calls. The Senate, one of the coins of the realm in the Senate is courtesy. Visit to Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid. They had some nice idle chatter back and forth with Harry Reid. So he's not sworn in yet. That'll probably be next week.
Colloquy, they call it, right? Isn't that,
what about
that, says that a bad hair thing?
What about over in the House? They must have just been cheering for him.
Oh, for Scott Brown? Yeah. Well, Scott Brown's election certainly has reset the whole situation in Congress, and everybody's talking about health care. John, you remember, God, even before Christmas, before New Year's, Democrats were in a mad rush to get health care done. We're pushing. We're going to get it done by New Year's. Well, listen to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, what she said about the mad rush to get health care done yesterday.
We're not in a big rush. Pause. Reflect upon what our possibilities are. See what the support is in the caucus. We have to always go where we can build consensus.
Super slow.
Nancy Pelosi is pulling in the sales on health care. Now, there is more than one rank-and-file member of Congress who is going around saying the big health care overhaul, the giant one, is dead. They're using those words. Now, the leadership is not saying that. They're still saying they still may go for a big package. I want to make that clear. But rank-and-file members are saying that it's dead. They're going to go for a more piecemeal approach. Health reform's not dead. They're still going to try to do some reforms, but not a big, bold Obama reform. The leadership remains to be seen, but support
not
is
exactly
winning.
Out of the limb on that one.
No, and not exactly a strategy. And as Anthony Weiner, congressman, said on our program yesterday, that's sort of three groups sort of off on their own.
That's
now.
Right.
Conservative Democrats, the progressives, and the Republicans.
And the ability to rein them all into one agenda seems to be slipping.
Right. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent.
All right, let's do a media takeout, shall we? Air America, the liberal radio network that helped boost the careers of Al Franken and Rachel Maddow, is filing for bankruptcy. Chapter 7, ceasing operations after 6 years on the air. It's tough in talk radio if you're not conservative, I think, is the basic gist of
that. That's the lesson there, I would say.
Joining us is Brian Stelter, the crack media reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Brian, good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
All right, this one's kind of been brewing for some time. What happened? What was the final nail in the coffin for Air America?
They had been bleeding for a long time, and I think the blood ran out for some reason this week. The final nail in the coffin was that it had rotated five or six times between five or six different owners and different management teams. And the most recent management team said, we tried to keep our heads above water, and the money ran out.
Why is it, Brian, that the Republican conservative talk does so well and liberal progressive talk does so poorly?
Talking to a number of former Air America staffers last night, and honestly now they're all former staffers, so we're talking about people that were happy there and unhappy there, both camps alike. They say conservative radio had a 20-year head start. You know, Rush Limbaugh is on stations with 50,000 watt signals that can reach across several states. Progressive radio simply can't get on those massive stations in many cases. They also say a lot of radio ownership, a lot of radio companies' owners are conservative, both in political take, but also in business practice. It's a risk. Progressive talk was a risk. And frankly, the Rush Limbaughs of the world are less of a risk for those owners.
But Brian,
there's a number of reasons.
Well, what do you say to the argument, no doubt someone will say it on Fox today, that the reason that Air America is no longer in existence is that the liberal talk radio already exists, the liberal media already exists. It's the New York Times, it's NBC, it's CBS, it's CNN.
Well, you know, there was a blog post by Media Matters, the progressive media watchdogs, last night, saying you can make that claim, or you can make the claim that liberal talk just doesn't sell, that no one wants to hear it. But you can't make both claims. And what I saw online last night were some conservatives trying to make both claims. And I think that's going to be something that will come up today. But, you know, we know that there's a big difference between what Rush Limbaugh says and the journalism that people strive for, even if they don't always quite get there. However, it is true that, you know, people who perhaps are on the left, they've got all these sources online, like blogs, that seem to have replaced, you know, talk radio in some ways as a meeting point online.
All right, and I would submit one other thing as a takeaway on this one. The two big stars, Al Franken, Rachel Maddow, they're not there anymore. They've moved on.
One's a senator.
I've heard that, yeah, and Rachel Maddow's on MSNBC. So, you know, is it a fact that they just didn't have anybody they wanted to listen to?
It was definitely a launchpad for them, and it was also a launchpad for several other radio hosts, not quite as big names, but people who have also started Air America, taken their shows off on their own, and actually done okay, at least by the standards of talk radio. For some reason, people didn't want to be inside that Air America tent. People say it was mismanaged. People say they didn't have a vision for what a talk radio network should be. For whatever reason, those people were able to go off on their own and have a better career elsewhere. However, and I think the legacy probably is Rachel Maddow and Al Franken.
Brian Stelter, who writes about the media for our partner, the New York Times. Good to have you with us on the program this morning.
There's also that Ed Schultz guy who's on MSNBC. He was on some Air America stations. Coming up, major telethon for Haiti airs tonight. Could beat all records for giving. We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. You can weigh in on anything you hear on the show. Today, we're coming to you specifically about the Supreme Court. It ruled that money is speech. But how do you view campaign cash? Is it political expression or a tool for corruption?
This is Chris from Brooklyn. You guys are talking there like it's doomsday and there is, you know, the days of regulation are over. That's not true. They can regulate through legislation to influence corporate law. And let's hope that they do that.
877-8MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, what could be a record-breaking telethon airs for Haiti tonight. We will look at the effectiveness of this kind of giving in a few moments. Here's some of the news stories we're following for you at 30 minutes past the hour. Relief workers in Haiti are shifting their focus to keeping survivors alive as hope fades for more rescues from the rubble. A massive relocation of 400,000 people is being planned as we speak. UN peacekeepers are now leveling land on the outskirts of Port-au-Prince and say the relocation could start next week. Meanwhile, search and rescue teams are packing up their dogs and gear as hopes for finding survivors from last week's earthquake dim. In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court says big business and labor unions have a free speech right to spend as much money as they want in elections. The Brookings Institution's Daryl West says expect to see a huge jump in spending this election year.
Politicians are not good at self-restraint. It's unlikely that candidates are going to limit themselves when the rules allow companies to spend as much as they want. That would really be political suicide on the part of candidates.
Disclosure rules remain intact, so an outside group paying for a campaign commercial will have to include a statement taking responsibility.
President Obama took on Wall Street yesterday, again, calling for tougher regulations that would limit the size of banks and limit their ability to engage in high-risk trades.
The American people will not be served by a financial system that comprises just a few massive firms. That's not good for consumers. It's not good for the economy.
The president's plan would stop banks from making investments that do not directly benefit customers. The markets loved the whole plan. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 213 points. Google appears to have regained its financial stride after wobbling through most of 2009. The internet search leader made nearly $2 billion in the last 3 months of the year. For the whole year, Google raked in $6.5 billion. Let's check in the markets. Asian and European markets down. Futures are down, although the NASDAQ futures were up last time I checked. Dow gets underway at 10,389. The S&P opens at 1,116. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,265. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
It's now been 10 days since that devastating earthquake in Haiti. And the airwaves are filled with messages like this.
Time is critical. Please text Haiti to the number you see on the screen. $5, $10, our collective drop in the bucket could lead to a river of hope.
In a moment, we're going to talk a little bit more about charity and about the big telethon tonight and how you can give wisely. But in the meantime, let's go down to Haiti and the BBC's Nick Tate, who is
Nick Davis. My apologies. Nick Davis is with us from Haiti. Nick, we're reading this morning about this plan to relocate 400,000 people out of Port-au-Prince, concern about disease there. Tell us a little bit about that and how things are going now in the effort to get some supplies and food to these people who so need it.
Two big questions. First of all, yes, the conditions in these camps and these makeshift camps which have sprung up all over the city, little tent cities. Actually, that's actually not the best way to describe them because they're not really tented. They're just really a patchwork of quilts, of zinc, of anything people can salvage from their homes. Obviously, there's no sanitation. Conditions are getting pretty bad. Far too many children running around in this sort of situation. So the Haitian authorities have set up these villages which are going to be springing up to the north and to the south of the capital, Port-au-Prince. The plan, therefore, to put up to 10,000 people in these specially constructed areas and these specially constructed villages so that people can actually start living properly. They can actually start living life the way it should be lived rather than the squalid conditions which exist in some of these makeshift camps which have sprung up all over the city.
Nick, if you could just tell us where you're standing right now. There's quite a bit of background noise, a lot of people around. I think I hear some music. And just tell us where you are and what you're seeing.
Well, the situation is I'm not actually that far from the airport. It's a little compound which the BBC have managed to get into. It's a small hotel, and there's lots of aid workers here, so we're getting it often firsthand in the evening, what they've seen, what they've been going through, them telling us their experiences. It's quite grim, it has to be said, in terms of what you see when you go around the city. I think you asked me just a short moment ago about aid and what aid is getting around to people in the city. And again, it's patchy. You can go into some areas and you can see water, you can see people getting food, and in others, nothing. There's an area called Cite Soleil, a very notorious ghetto shantytown in Port-au-Prince. And despite the fact it being not too far from here, not too far from the airport, it just seems a bit odd that, you know, US Marines are fanning out to rural areas to deliver food and to get aid to people when just down the street there are people who haven't eaten for 9 days.
Wow, that's an interesting paradox right there. Nick, and that brings up an important point here. We're about to talk about how people can help and how people should or should not give money to help, but it sounds like it's not lack of money is not the problem. Is that accurate to say?
No, I think money is still important. People shouldn't get to a point where they think there's no point in giving money. The problem is that this is a logistical nightmare. The infrastructure of this country is gone. The government was pretty much decapitated by what's happened. What it needs is some form of proper organisation. The US is working with the UN to do that. But at the moment, things just don't seem to be gelling.
Nick Davis with the BBC in that aid compound there, bringing us up to date.
Wow.
Thank you very much for that.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, Clinton was saying the Haitians get to reimagine their country.
Probably pushing it. Ask people on the streets there, I think they might give an interesting response to that. Tonight, the American public will be asked to dig even deeper into their wallets. MTV's Hope for Haiti telethon is airing. A lot of celebrities participating, and it's across several channels as well. Ken Berger is the president and CEO of Charity Navigator. It's an organization that evaluates how well charities are operating. And Ken, good to have you with us on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us, first of all, about this outpouring. Put this in some perspective for us. It sounds like there's been a tremendous response.
Yes, in 8 days, over $300 million has been raised already. And to put that in some context, during the Asian tsunamis in the first comparable number of days, it was about half that amount.
Wow.
Whereas in the case of the Katrina, it was about $450 million. But it's definitely up there as one of the all-time greatest examples of American generosity that we've ever seen. And it's also been historic with certain kinds of giving, such as text messaging, and we've never seen anything like it.
Tell us a little bit about this text message giving.
Well, you know, the Red Cross in 2008 raised about $200,000 from text messaging. So far, the Red Cross alone has raised over $25 million just from text messaging. And it really is opening a door to a whole new category of givers. Many much younger givers are participating in this. And so as a consequence of that, it's just been amazing. I mean, I know that when I communicate with my daughter, text messaging is the way. This is just never been seen. And so for the first time, people are taking very seriously that these sorts of means of giving are now seriously on the landscape and will be here from now on.
Well, Ken, help me understand, though, if I give money via text on my phone, is the phone company making money off of this, or are they donating this transmission, if you will?
Normally, the answer to that question would be yes, but all of the major carriers have made a commitment to not have any fees associated with this, and in addition, they've expedited getting the money to the charities. Normally, it would take as much as 90 days for text, believe it or not, for text messaging donations.
There's some irony. Instant giving and 90 days to make sure that somebody pays the bill.
But they've expedited, though.
Right?
That's
good to hear.
That's great to hear.
That's good to hear. Ken Berger, the president and CEO of Charity Navigator, thanks very much, and we'll be watching that telethon tonight.
Yes, on virtually all the networks tonight. Coming up, we're going to talk with John Yoo, the author of the Bush administration's so-called torture memos. How does he feel as a lawyer about the evolution of executive power? We're going to ask him later on this hour.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Miles O'Brien in for Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry, and Joe is part of our program this morning.
I think if anything, what we've seen is a society of people that are tired of taking everybody's junk anymore if they were peed off, so to speak.
He's responding to the Democrats' loss in Massachusetts, and we've been checking in with listeners for what you think. What were people deciding on up there? Were they voting on health care? Were they choosing Republicans over Democrats? Or, like Joe, were they just throwing out the incumbents, throwing out the bums?
In New Jersey, Corzine said he was going to do something, and we voted him out because he didn't do it. And now we don't like what was going to happen with the message, so Scott Brown got voted in. So the bottom line is, just don't tick us off as a voter. Do what you say what you're going to do, and you'll still have a job.
I think they just like the Cosmo guy who drove a truck.
Scott Brown, yes.
But some of you thought Brown's win had nothing to do with incumbents and everything to do with special interests. We got this email. I don't think this election is a message to Obama and the Democrats. I think special interests, probably the health insurance companies, came in at the last minute and dumped tons of money into Brown's campaign. How else could he have raised $1 million a day in the last week? Obama is trying to change things, but it's impossible to do. There's a bleak note
That's
for Friday.
That's a bleak note, yeah. Frustrated note, yeah. Yes. But for people outside of Massachusetts, Miles, the message we heard is that their vote was all about one thing, health care.
This is Tim from New Jersey. The health care is clearly an issue. Most people don't have the opportunity to vote against this health care reform. Fortunately, the people from Massachusetts did, and they clearly have spoken. For a state that was so heavily Democratic for so many years, and now to go to Republican, it's a clear message that's being told.
And that's what Scott Brown, that was his campaign. He made that his campaign. So,
well, of course, worth pointing out, 37% Democratic in Massachusetts, not what people think.
That's right.
But did voters in Massachusetts vote for Republicans because they are against the health care reform, or is it just because they already have health care there?
A statewide program.
Good point, right?
This is Ellen from New Hampshire on the Senate race in Massachusetts. And since Massachusetts already has a health care plan in place, couldn't that simply be why the state is disinterested in higher taxes on a program that they don't need?
And that was a Scott Brown argument, actually, during the campaign. What if people in Massachusetts voted for none of those reasons, though? Here's Joan writing on our website, thetakeaway.org. As a lifelong Massachusetts resident, the election of Scott Brown to the Senate was based on several factors. Let's not forget, Martha Coakley is a woman. Sexism does exist, Joan writes. If it didn't, why isn't the Senate reflective of the population? Also, Massachusetts grows more and more segregated. As an educator, I finally see diversity when I set foot on campus. But going out in the evening in Massachusetts renders little or no diversity, she says. And quite frankly, the white population could care less. I believe I would feel more comfortable in Minnesota. I at least think their diversity is genuine and not constructed. Well, Joan's getting a lot off her, out of her heart.
Venting
there.
On a Friday, yeah, I think, indeed, there, I a little think, yeah. bit. Well, I hope she feels better. You can weigh in on anything you hear on our show or in the news. Today, we're coming to you specifically about the Supreme Court. It's ruled that money is speech, but how do you view campaign cash? Is it political expression or a tool for corruption? We've been getting some very interesting takes from you.
I'm really interested to know if there is any tracking going to be placed on these corporations with the right to speech as to who owns them. Where are their stockholders? Which countries?
We've been getting a lot of responses. One writer, Hardy, says on our site, am I missing something? Or did the Supreme Court just grant U.S. citizenship right to foreigners? Halliburton is registered in the Caymans. Call us with your take, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or on the website, thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
John Huckabee here with Miles O'Brien in for Celeste Headlee. Coming up, a conversation with Justice Department Attorney John Yoo, former Justice Department Attorney John Yoo, author of the Bush administration's so-called torture memos. Right now, here's a check on stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Supreme Court has paved the way to allow big businesses and unions to spend millions to help sway presidential and congressional elections. Reaction to the 5-4 ruling?
It's probably one of the three or four decisions in the history of the Supreme Court that most undermines democracy. We will regret the day that this decision has been issued.
Others in Washington applauded the decision. President Obama took another swipe at Wall Street.
Never again will the American taxpayer be held hostage by a bank that is too big to fail.
President called for new regulations.
The battle between Hillary Clinton and China over internet freedom continues to escalate. Yesterday, Clinton said the internet should not be heavily censored.
Just as these technologies must not be used to punish peaceful political speech, they must also not be used to persecute or silence religious minorities.
A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman snapped back, saying the U.S. is, quote, should stop unreasonable accusations in the name of so-called internet freedom. Those are some of the stories we're watching.
Our next guest is probably always going to be known as the lawyer who wrote the so-called torture memo. John Yoo, a deputy assistant attorney general at the Justice Department between 01 and 03, helped establish the legal framework for the Bush administration's enhanced interrogation techniques. The memos expanded the president's power in times of war. John Yoo, now a law professor at the University of California at Berkeley, has written a new book that examines the history of growing executive power. Yoo's new book is called Crisis in Command, A History of Executive Power from George Washington to George W. Bush. John Yoo, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I saw your appearance on The Daily Show. I have to say, you know, Jon Stewart had it so in for you, and you just were the nicest guy. I mean, I'm telling you, your students must have loved that.
Well, you have to keep in mind that I've spent my career learning how to calm down unruly students who've not done the reading for class.
Oh, and that's what happened with Jon Stewart?
Exactly.
Well, what I'd like to do is, first of all, let's talk about the premise of this book, Crisis and Command. In some ways, it's a story of the change, the evolution of the Constitution, and the rise of executive power in the United States. You describe in a couple of places in the book that executive power and a president's motivation and kind of righteous use of it comes from a sense that they represent this quality of the majority's intent, that when presidents act unilaterally or try to, they believe they have the power of the majority of the American people behind them, right?
When you look at these presidents and their emergencies, they really believe they're doing what's in the nation's best interest, and they draw on the fact that they were elected. They're the only official, other than the vice president, elected by the whole country, whereas Congress is often seen or described as an accumulation of lots of special interests because they're all elected by narrow constituencies. The reason you need an executive branch is because things like the Civil War or a 9/11 happen, and we need a part of the government that can act swiftly and decisively on behalf of the country, because Congress is too slow, too riven by special interests to act decisively.
Well, let's talk about the emergency of 9/11 and your role in drafting the so-called torture memo. What was the job there? I don't quite understand it. I mean, here were these people at the Department of Justice coming to you and explicitly asking for what precisely?
It's a fairly obscure office. It's very small, only has 20 lawyers. So the question came to the Justice Department from the CIA, the National Security Council, and the White House, just a few months after 9/11, we're talking about the spring of 2002, one of the leaders of al-Qaeda, the person who's thought to be the number three leader of al-Qaeda, was captured by our intelligence agencies, and he was not cooperating and resistant to sort of standard questioning. So the question was, what could our interrogators do that did not cross the line into torture, which no one wanted to violate that, no one wanted to violate that ban, but was tougher than what we do in the law enforcement world, which is Miranda warnings, and you get a lawyer, you don't have to talk at all.
But, you know, the The thing I have a problem with there is, I mean, did you really think that if you'd said, you, there in that obscure office, had said, you can't do anything, dudes, that they would have listened to you at all?
No, that's the reason they came to the lawyers in the first place. I do not believe that they had a pre-decided outcome in mind where they said, oh, we're just going to do A through Z, and we don't care what the lawyers say. If they were going to do that, why ask for a lawyer's advice at all?
All right, but you may believe that, but the administration at certain points was happy to ignore the advice of lawyers who said they were doing way too much. Isn't that the case? Which makes it sound like maybe what the CIA and the White House did was, we can go down to this obscure office in DOJ and get John Yoo. He'll do it.
Well, I'm not like Mikey and the cereal or something, if that's what you're implying. I think the point is that at this time, nobody knew what the legal standards were in this gray area between what the law enforcement process allows one to do and what the statutes prohibit, because this was an unforeseen experience which we as a country had never confronted before. The second thing is, this is a job of this office in times of war. It's not as if the people in the White House said, oh, there's this little office, let's just ask them because they'll give us the answer we want. This is the function of the office when it comes to covert action. The Justice Department signs off on almost all covert actions, and the office I was working for plays that function all the time. So this is not unusual that this office,
right,
which is also, let me say, has the last word on legal disputes within the executive branch. So there are lots of lawyers who work in the government, and they can have lots of different views. And that's not uncommon, and in fact probably welcome, that a lot of lawyers would argue about what's the legal answer for something. But the final word when there are those disputes is in the Attorney General, and the Attorney General gives that function to our office.
Do you believe, since the Obama administration appears to be continuing with the military tribunal policy under the Bush administration, that a lot of the issues and legal opinions that you drafted that are so controversial are actually going to be enshrined as legal doctrine if the Obama administration basically allows this to proceed?
I think in terms of the legal authorities, I agree with you. I think the Obama administration is drawing on many of the same constitutional principles that the Bush administration did. You mentioned military commissions. The Obama administration suggested initially they were going to shut them down, but now they're going to keep them. Detaining people without putting them into the criminal civilian jury trial process. Again, they suggested when they campaigned that this would end. Now that they're in office, they're continuing that. So they have to be drawing on the same authorities. Now, but on the other hand, in terms of the choices they're making, what to do, I think they have softened, primarily in their decisions on how to treat people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, to put him in the civilian trial system in New York City, or the Detroit Christmas Day bomber who was almost immediately put into the law enforcement process. Those two decisions probably would not have been made by the Bush administration.
Anything you regret from those years that you developed your reputation? And obviously you have a much bigger career than that, but you are the guy who wrote the torture memo, and that's what they're going to say in the New York Times obit.
The way the journalism industry is going, I hope to outlive the New York Times at this point. But let me say this.
You're good. You're good. But answer the question, counselor.
I think I'll be alive after the New York Times goes bankrupt.
No regrets?
No, let me answer your question.
Yeah, thank you.
I mean, I think that I don't regret what I did. I mean, I was there. I had a job to do. I was proud to be able to help the country during a time of terrible emergency when we've been attacked. Obviously, I wish we had more time. I mean, we were under enormous pressure of time and circumstances. And you might say, look, you could reach a different decision. I'm the first to say, you know, it's always possible people make mistakes, and you should look back and say, could I have done something differently? But if I was put back in the same place at the same time, I would still have made basically the same decisions. I regret that our country and I ever had to make those decisions, but I would still have made them.
John Yoo is the former Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the Justice Department, serving in his post from 01 to 03. His new book is called Crisis in Command, A History of Executive Power from George Washington to George W. Bush.
He's a glib guy.
Yeah, I mean, he's a lawyer. He's definitely a lawyer.
Yeah. If you missed anything, we're always here on The Takeaway. Take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or at iTunes. All day today, we're covering the impact from the Supreme Court's decision that money is speech.
How do you view campaign cash? Is it political expression or a tool for corruption? Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to our website, thetakeaway.org. I'm Miles O'Brien, in for Celeste Headlee. She's back on Monday.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Happy Friday, folks. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.